Pakistan's military said on Friday that it wasn't preparing for war after last week's deadly attack in the disputed provinces of Jammu and Kashmir. On February 14th, 40 Indian police officers were killed in a suicide bombing carried out by a Pakistan-based terrorist group. The attack sparked massive protests in India against Pakistan and refocused attention on the two nuclear-armed enemies. American University history professor Peter Kuznick, who heads the school's Nuclear Studies Institute, says India is stoking the flame that are being lit by Pakistan.
Last week, there was an important terrorist incident in Kashmir in which Pakistani-linked terrorists exploded a bomb that killed at least 40 Indian soldiers. This is a crisis that's been ongoing for decades. In fact, India and Pakistan have fought three wars since independence in 1947. Two of the wars have been over Kashmir. The situation there has not been resolved. You've got a largely Muslim population that has been bristling under Indian control. The United Nations has called upon India to allow a referendum in that area, and India has refused to do so. And so this has always been a hotbed. The terrorists in that region have been closely tied to the ISI, to Pakistani intelligence. And so we've had quite a few situations there that have gone close to war. There have been two or three major terrorist attacks by Pakistani-linked terrorists in India. In 2001, there was the attack on the Indian parliament. And then in 2008, there was the terrorist attack in Mumbai, in which they went after the luxury hotels, the train station, the Jewish center, and 166 Indians were killed there. After the 2001 terrorist incident, both sides mobilized more than 1 million troops, and the world thought, quaked at the prospect of India and Pakistan going to war at that point. Both countries had just tested their nuclear weapons in 1998. So the scenario that most people predicted was that the Indian army would overwhelm the Pakistani army, Pakistan would retaliate with tactical nuclear weapons, India would respond with its nuclear weapons, and we'd have a full-scale nuclear war. That seemed almost likely at that point. And you had cavalier statements by military leaders on both sides. The leading Pakistani general said, well, you can get killed crossing the street, getting hit by a car, you can get killed in a nuclear war, what's the difference? So with that kind of thinking, that heightened our concern over the danger at that point. There was another incident in 2016 in which 19 were killed, and now this incident in which 40 Indian troops were killed, and there have been a couple other smaller terrorist incidents surrounding that. What's happening in India is Prime Minister Modi, who's a conservative Buddhist Hindu nationalist, with the BJP party, is up for re-election in May. And it looks, for what I've been seeing, closely contested election in which Rahul Gandhi, heading a coalition of opposing parties, has a good shot of winning. So Modi has to show how tough he is. He can't back down against this Pakistani assault. So he's been threatening an Indian response, which again puts us back in that situation potentially we're in 2001. The India's army is about twice the size of Pakistan's army. India's overall military is about twice the size of Pakistan's military, far more tanks, delivery vehicles, and spending. But the problem is, on top of that, we figure that Pakistan probably has 150 nuclear weapons. India has approximately 140 nuclear weapons. So the danger of war between those two countries is something that has happened before and could happen again. Inside India, people are aroused, to put it mildly. Modi's Nationalist Party has been urging people, encouraging people to come out in the streets. And they're coming out in the streets with rallies, which they're holding signs, attack Pakistan, crush it. So the Indian nationalists are out calling for blood. the Indian government is taking various other measures, cutting off water to the parts of Kashmir that where the terrorists seem to have their stronghold, cutting off bus service, and doing what they can to punish the Kashmiris. And also inside of India, the High Court in India ruled that the attempts to punish Kashmiri students in India and other Kashmiris in India must stop. So they've got a volatile, explosive situation. And what does a war between India and Pakistan mean? The scientists who have been working on nuclear winter came out with recent studies that show that even a limited nuclear war between India and Pakistan, in which 100 Hiroshima-sized nuclear weapons were used, could create partial nuclear winter, the incineration of cities, sending so much smoke and soot and debris into the atmosphere that it would block the sun's rays, cause the temperatures on the earth to plummet, destroy agriculture in many parts of the world for a long period of time, and lead to between 1 and 2 billion deaths. A limited nuclear war between India and Pakistan, which were 100 Hiroshima-sized nuclear weapons. We know that even the weapons that India and Pakistan have are bigger than that, and there's the possibility of 300 nuclear weapons being used. So the consequences will be devastating not only in India and Pakistan, but also devastating globally. Now, on the more optimistic side, or positive side, is that Imran Khan, the new prime minister of Pakistan, seems to have been sincerely reaching out to India, not only now, but in over the past year, to try to improve relations. What we know about the situation there is that even though he's close to the army, he doesn't really have the ultimate control. In Pakistan, the military and the ISI, the intelligence services, have much more power than the prime minister does. So I think that Khan has been a positive force, and I'm hopeful that if Rahul Gandhi wins in the upcoming election in India, that there might be a basis for finally, after all these decades, 7 decades, moving toward resolving some of these crisis conflict. But right now the situation is very, very dangerous. And the United States has not been paying much attention. Other countries are paying more attention. The Saudi Crown Prince was just in India. Pakistan is closely aligned with China. India and China have their own tensions. So this could spiral even out of control, even more than just between India and Pakistan, if something does begin there. And it looks like very likely that the Indians are going to retaliate. We don't know how they're going to retaliate, where they're going to retaliate. They've already been taking a lot of steps, and hopefully it doesn't go beyond that.
What is the United States' role in all of this? The Trump administration seems to be taking India's side, maybe because of their anti-Muslim prejudices in the United States. What do we think is going to happen there?
Well, the United States has long been calling on Pakistan to crack down on the terrorists that operate in Pakistan. We've seen them, the effects of their policies in terms of Afghanistan, where a lot of the Afghan insurgents are linked to Pakistani intelligence and go back and forth from Pakistan into Afghanistan. So the U.S. has tried to put pressure. The danger of putting too much pressure on the Pakistani government is that there are a lot of terrorists within Pakistan. Pakistan has 150 or close, or somewhere between 140 and 150 nuclear weapons. The fear is what happens if those nuclear weapons fall into the hands of the extremists inside Pakistan. There have been a lot of steps taken, but the U.S. relationship to Pakistan has not been good. China has improved relations. China has been giving a lot of economic aid to Pakistan of late. And India has been moving closer to the United States. We talk about the U.S. Indo-U.S.-Indian alliances in terms of military exercises and drills that have been going on. India, for a long time, had maintained neutrality. During the Cold War, Nehru was really the leader of the Third World Neutralist Bloc, which John Foster Dulles and others deplored. And Nehru often was the leading critic of atmospheric testing, of the nuclear arms race, calling for nuclear disarmament globally, nuclear abolition. And there were, India played a positive role in terms of mobilizing the Third World against the two superpowers and blocs in the Cold War. But lately, India has been moving closer toward the United States, not in a way that necessarily precludes its dealing with Russia and other countries. So the United States has been critical of Pakistan and has been calling for Pakistan to crack down on the terrorist cells that still operate pretty freely inside of Pakistan.
Well, how about Russia?
Russia has got its own concerns right now. And this past week, Vladimir Putin gave his address to the Duma, the State of the Nation address to the Duma, which most of it was devoted to economic development, infrastructure, improving services, improving education, garbage collection, the things that the Russian people wanted to hear. But he said that we can have both guns and butter, and so he devoted a certain portion of the speech to his criticism of the United States. The big issue lately has been Trump's announcement that the U.S. giving 6 months' notice about withdrawing from the INF Treaty. This is a very dangerous and destabilizing move on the part of the United States. The INF Treaty is one of the two remaining treaties that are standing between the world now and a new nuclear arms race. So the INF Treaty was negotiated back in 1987 between Reagan and Gorbachev after they failed to abolish nuclear weapons the previous year at Reykjavik. They came back and at least decided they could eliminate an entire class of nuclear weapons, which they did in the INF Treaty. And that eased tensions at a time when relations were certainly improving in the late 1980s. What that did was it got rid of the intermediate range missiles that were in Europe, the Russian Soviet SS-20s and the U.S. Pershing missiles and other missiles that we put in Europe in response. The danger is now, as the danger was then, that these missiles are so close to Europe and to inside Europe and so close to Moscow that the Russians feared that they would only have 10 to 12 minutes to respond if they got word of a launch. Often there are false alerts about these kinds of launches. And if you've only got 10 to 12 minutes to respond before you're afraid you're going to get hit, then terrible things can happen. The intercontinental ballistic missiles at least give about 30 minutes of warning time. And so Gorbachev and Reagan agreed to abolish this class of weapons. They only, unfortunately, abolished ground-launched missiles. They still retained the sea-launched missiles and the air-launched missiles. So the United States had a huge advantage at that point. But Russia has since rebuilt its capabilities in terms of air-launched and sea-launched missiles. So even with the INF Treaty, the danger still is quite high. But it's gotten worse because now Trump says he wants the U.S. to withdraw. This is something that Bolton has been calling for years. You have to realize that people like Bolton and increasingly Pompeo and others don't like any of these international treaties that put constraints upon the United States. What they want is they prefer an unfettered arms race. And Trump, of course, would go for something like that. And he said, well, if we have an arms race, then bring it on. He says, we're going to show we can outspend the Russians and anybody else, and we're much stronger, and we're going to win an arms race. Sort of like the Reagan strategy in the early 1980s in some ways. But what it creates is a very dangerous situation. So if the INF Treaty goes, first of all, what Putin threatened in his speech this week was that there's going to be an equivalent response on Russia's part to anything the United States does. If the U.S. puts these missiles in Europe, then Russia is going to deploy missiles at the same distance from the United States in submarines, other kinds of sea-launched ballistic missiles that Russia has. What Putin said in his March 1st 2018 State of the Nation address, which he reiterated in this speech this past week, is that Russia has developed five new nuclear weapons, all of which can circumvent U.S. missile defense, something we warned about all along, that the missile defense that the United States has spent so much money on and places so much faith in can be easily circumvented or defeated with initially with lots and lots of decoys and with more missiles, and now with new nuclear weapons that have the capability of defeating the missile defense systems. Then the other thing that's worrisome to us is that in 2 years, in February of 2021, the New START treaty also comes up for renewal or ends at that point. Putin has indicated that the Russians want to maintain the New START treaty and to extend it. Mm-hmm. Trump's response was that the United States does not want to extend the New START treaty. Again, very, very dangerous situation. So what we're looking at in 2 years is getting back to a 1980s style Cold War nuclear arms race. At that point, there were close to 70,000 nuclear weapons in the world. I remember that when I take my students every summer to Hiroshima and Nagasaki, I used to continually, every year, write down one statistic at the Atomic Bomb Museum in Hiroshima. And it said that by 1985, the world had accumulated the equivalent of 1.47 million Hiroshima bombs. 1.47 million Hiroshima bombs. The species was insane at that point. How many times over do we have to have the capability to wipe out life on this planet before we're satisfied? And that's what Trump and Bolton and others envision as increasing America's security or increasing America's domination, America's hegemony. Well, they have to wake up because the era of American unipolarity is over. It was back in 1990 when Charles Krauthammer, the neocon leading thinker at that point, said that with the collapse of the Soviet Union, we've entered the period of unipolarity. And he said that this is the unipolar moment, is what he called it. And he said it could last for 30 or 40 years with nobody being able to threaten or challenge the United States. And then in 2003, after the invasion of Afghanistan seemed to be going well in the beginning, Krauthammer announced that it's no longer the unipolar moment. Now it's the unipolar era. It's going to last indefinitely into the future. Well, things didn't go so well after we invaded Iraq, and things went bad in Afghanistan. And so by 2005, even Krauthammer said, well, I was over-optimistic. The unipolar era is over, and we don't know how long the unipolar moment is going to last. Well, it didn't last. Now Russia has rebuilt its military, and China has challenged us economically, and India will soon have a bigger population than China. So American unipolarity, American hegemony, the era of the Pax Americana is over already, and we're being challenged in these ways. But Trump, you know, given his view of the world, thinks that we can spend ourselves back into unipolarity. It doesn't work that way. And so the conflicts that he's been exacerbating between China, the U.S. and China, and the U.S. and Russia, the interesting thing, so Trump is always attacked as being Putin's puppet or Putin's poodle, and that Putin is pulling the strings. Well, if we look at it objectively, relations between the U.S. and Russia are worse now than they've been, certainly since the 1980s, and arguably since the Cuban Missile Crisis. So it's a very, very dangerous situation. It's partly why the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists moved the hands of the doomsday clock in January 2018 back to 2 minutes before midnight. They had done that in 1953 after Russia tested what we thought at the time was their hydrogen bomb. Then they moved it to 2 minutes before midnight. And then gradually things got a little bit more sane and they moved the clock back. But now so many situations are really dangerous that could spin out of control.
President Trump has been very vocal on nuclear weapons in particular, and bragging over his increase in the defense budget to the over 700 and change $1 billion. Do you think that he and the president, the leader of North Korea, should get the Nobel Peace Prize for their work?
Well, you know that Trump asked Abe to nominate him for the Nobel Peace Prize, and Abe dutifully did so. You would think that this is a comedy routine, the thought that Trump would win the Nobel Peace Prize. But we've had a few other comical winners in the past. We had Teddy Roosevelt. We had Henry Kissinger. You know, when Kissinger won the Nobel Peace Prize, he and his counter Vietnamese negotiator won it together at that point. But at least the Vietnamese had the integrity to turn it down because the war hadn't even ended at that point. But Kissinger accepted the Nobel Peace Prize. The great political satirist Tom Lehrer said at the time that he gave up performing. And he said political satire became obsolete when Henry Kissinger won the Nobel Peace Prize. Well, I think political satire has again become obsolete when Donald Trump has been nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize. That doesn't mean that negotiations with Korea aren't important. The reason why we've gotten to this point is because Moon Jae-in, the South Korean leader, took the initiative and refused to go along with Trump's insistence that he back down from approaching the North Koreans. This is Moon Jae-in. Moon Jae-in was brought to power by the Candlelight Revolution that took place there. This is a very popular uprising, and the South Korean people were fed up, not just with Park Jun-hee's rule, but the increasing belligerence. And people were very frightened. Remember back to late 2017, after Trump started, now certainly North Korea was not blameless in what was going on. They had just tested a nuclear bomb that they said was a hydrogen bomb that had, we estimate, maybe 140 times as powerful as the Hiroshima bomb. And then they tested intercontinental ballistic missiles that could reach the continental United States. So North Korea was being very, very provocative in its own way. And then Trump, of course, takes the situation and exacerbates it. We were very close to war, or at least it seemed that way, in late 2017. Richard Haass, the head of the Council on Foreign Relations, said that he thought there was a 50-50 chance that we were going to go to war in North Korea, with North Korea. And that would have been horrifying. Even if they didn't use nuclear weapons, they had so much conventional artillery on the border, 35 miles from Seoul, a city of 25 million, it would have been nightmarish. Fortunately, after Trump exacerbates the situation and brings it up to the verge of warfare, then he backed down and started to become much more sane about relations with North Korea, to the point now where he says he and Kim Jong-un have been sending each other love letters. It's great that they're meeting again in Hanoi. The U.S. media is already saying it's a failure, even before the meeting takes place. They're warning that Trump's going to give away the store there. The intelligence community is making similar kinds of warnings. Well, that's not what I'm concerned about. I think that the situation we have now is so much better, so much healthier than what it was a year ago, that even though everybody's making fun of Trump, that he got nothing from it, what we have now is that North Korea has stopped testing missiles, has stopped testing bombs. The United States has stopped the provocative war games that it was conducting. They've been talking, exchanging ideas. That diplomacy has replaced threatening belligerence and warfare. So the bellicose rhetoric has stopped, and now we have to figure out how we can begin to move slowly, beginning to build up trust between our two sides. There are things the United States can do. There are things that North Korea can do. The United States can allow the joint economic enterprises between North Korea and South Korea that have been blocked by UN sanctions and that the United States has not allowed the South Koreans to continue doing, the railroad lines and other things like that. We can reopen the industrial park, the Kaesong Industrial Park. So a lot of things that can be done. The United States can also begin easing sanctions. That's a big issue for North Korea. North Korea says so long as the U.S. maintains these sanctions, then there's a hostile relationship, and they're not going to begin to move. North Korea can put a freeze on its fissile materials. There are other measures that North Korea can take. We can start moving incrementally. When the U.S. was saying, well, they promised complete denuclearization, that's not true. They never did that, and not unilateral denuclearization. What we need, we've got a vast amount of U.S. troops in South Korea. We can begin lessening the U.S. troops, easing the sanctions, stop the threats, and crucial to the North Koreans is a peace treaty from the Korean War that was fought between 1950 and 1953. That war did not end with a peace treaty. What it ended was an armistice. So we're still technically at war all these decades later. First, we can at least make a declaration of peace and then move to a formal treaty. That would go a big way to assuaging any of the North Korean fears.
Peter Kuznick, how would you in a minute sum up the situation, and how should citizens of the world confront the way the world is going the way it is today?
What we're facing now is that all nine nuclear nations are modernizing their nuclear arsenals, led by the United States, by Barack Obama. The United States announced then it was going to be a $1 trillion nuclear modernization over 30 years. The estimate now is that it's going to be at least a $1.7 trillion nuclear modernization. I can think of a lot of better things that money could be used for, but it's going to be to make America's nuclear arsenal more efficient and more usable, which is insanity. But the world is insane right now in terms of creating destructive capabilities. We waste so much of our resources on perfecting our means of killing rather than our means of keeping people alive in a world in which the richest 8 people have more wealth than the poorest 3.8 billion people. So I think we need to change our priorities. And it's not going to happen if we depend on the leaders themselves to take that initiative. The people have got to become educated, knowledgeable, and put pressure on their elected officials. We need to be seeing rallies. Back in 1982, there were 1 million people demonstrating in New York Central Park for cutting back on the nuclear arms race. Barack Obama was even out there. You know, but we've got to begin mobilizing again, taking this into the hands of the people, not only here, but all over the world. What we need is some kind of international leadership. Right now, there are no statesmen in the world. What you got is a series of pygmies in all these different countries. Donald Trump might be the most egregious example of somebody who's got no vision and is exacerbating, blowing up situations, ripping up the Iran nuclear deal, and creating worse relations with Russia now. But he's got a lot of company right now among these narrow-minded, short-sighted nationalists who are running every major country. So what we need, though, is for the leaders of the world to sit down and begin to figure out ways that we can ease tensions, work together to solve some of these crises, to solve some of the problems, to create a much more democratic and a much safer, more peaceful world. It can be done. You know, as Jack Kennedy said, we created all of these situations so we can uncreate them. It's in our hands, but the United States has not had a real leader since Kennedy, the last year of his presidency, maybe early Carter, you could say, and maybe sometimes Obama's, at least in his speeches, was thinking in these kinds of terms. But in reality, we've had leaders in most of the major countries who have been pushing very narrow nationalist agendas that are making the world more dangerous. The fact that we can't move together on to deal with climate change is crazy. So we need international leadership. The people have got to mobilize to put pressure on their leaders to begin to do the right thing, not to play on the biases and the prejudices and these parochial tendencies, but to begin to think in terms of the human species, begin to think in terms of the future of the planet. And that's what the world's people should demand of their leaders. But so far, I'm not seeing very much that's really encouraging, unfortunately.
Thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.